in America.
One of the red lines of Iran's negotiating position, and this is very important, is that Iran has rejected a step-for-step process. Now, this is not to be confused with a step-by-step. Now, if the Americans want to lift sanctions step-by-step, fine. They shouldn't expect any moves from Iran. They can just lift them slowly. Once they've been lifted, verifiably, Iran will go back into full compliance. But what is an absolute no-no is a step-for-step. So they take one step, we take one step. That's been rejected out of hand.
There are some individuals and also groups inside the country who seem to be unsatisfied with the results of the negotiations. But on the other hand, outside of the country, there are many opposing voices here and there. Countries such as Saudi Arabia are worried, and we know that the Israeli regime is doing its best to deviate the negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 from its current path. Also, hardliners, Republicans, and the Tea Party in the US are extremely against any agreements and lifting of sanctions.
For all parties, it's best at this point to make the most of intermediaries and wise men. That's been the intention. And negotiations have been held both at the level of experts and within the working group set up in the previous rounds of the talks in Vienna. Whatever the results now, the JCPOA Commission will reconvene whenever it is necessary.
Well, I think we can safely say the situation is still unclear. You know, sometimes one party comes and says a deal can be struck within a few weeks or is within reach, and then the spokesperson for the American State Department comes and says completely different, pours cold water on that. So quite frankly, I think we're not getting a sufficient amount of clear information.
Previously, Iranian officials had reported progress in the talks. They said the two sides had agreed that the U.S. would lift sanctions on Iran's energy and banking sectors, which are JCPOA-related, in contrast to the 2019 sanctions on persons and entities the U.S. deems terrorist. But what the U.S. agreed was not enough to satisfy the Iranian officials. Iran continues to maintain the U.S. pulled out of the agreement and should therefore lift all economic sanctions before Iran takes any steps to return to compliance with the JCPOA. That's it for today, but there's plenty more coming up, as nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And it won't be easy, as Iran won't accept any new nuclear demands. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after for Press TV's analyses and realistic predictions. Thanks from the whole team, and bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Eid al-Fitr prayers show us appreciation for divine blessings during Ramadan. In a sense, Eid al-Fitr prayers are our appreciation of divine blessings in the month of Ramadan. It is an appreciation of this new birth. During Eid al-Fitr prayers, we repeatedly say to God, "Make us benefit from all the goods which Muhammad and his household benefited from." We say to God, "Let us enter the pure paradise of faith, morality, and action which you allowed these chosen ones enter." Then we say, "And get us out of all the evils which you helped Muhammad and his household, your greetings be upon him and them all, get out of." During Eid al-Fitr prayers, we ask God to help us get out of the hell of immoral actions, conduct, and beliefs from which he protected these great and dear imams. We illustrate this great goal for ourselves on the day of Eid al-Fitr, and we ask God to help us reach this goal. Of course, we ourselves have a responsibility to make efforts to stay on the straight path. This is what piety is.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Eid al-Fitr is an Eid of divine mercy. Spending the month of Ramadan in worship, fasting, tawassul, dhikr and humility until the last day is a true Eid for a faithful person. This Eid is not similar to materialistic and worldly celebrations. Eid al-Fitr is an Eid of divine mercy. It is an Eid of divine forgiveness. It is an occasion for thanking God, an occasion for the people to thank God for having been able to worship God for a month and to successfully celebrate the great divine Eid at the end of it for having been able to benefit as much as possible from dhikr, dua, tawassul, humility, fasting and praying in the month of Ramadan. This is an Eid for pious Muslims who have successfully spent a month in worship and abstinence, hoping that Allah the Exalted would bestow mercy and divine rewards on them. What are the things offered at Ramadan feasts? It is said that the month of Ramadan is the month of a divine feast, and I would like to tell you, dear brothers and sisters, what could be expected to be offered in this feast? One of the things that are offered and people like you and I should benefit from it is fasting. Another thing is the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran has been placed on this blessed table, and we have been given more opportunities to recite it in the month of Ramadan than in any other month. Another thing is prayers such as Dua Iftitah and Dua Abu Hamza. All of these things are the blessing that are offered at this divine feast. There are some people who are so much distracted by other things that they do not even notice these blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the World with Reporters.
In London, thousands hit the streets furious at Israel demanding an end to the continued onslaught of Palestinians, while incensed at the evident bias in much of the mainstream media coverage, which is accused of shamelessly pushing the Israeli narrative.
There's a well-established channel between the Israeli government and between all mainstream news sources, meaning that they get threatened with legal action, they get aggressive emails and letters and even tweets from members of the Israeli government.
All the media pretty much has been disgraceful, and they do. They buy this narrative that these are clashes between two hostile camps that are completely incomprehensible, as if, you know, both sides are equally culpable. What is happening here is a continuation, a deepening, an acceleration of Israeli aggression.
Organisations like the BBC, funded by the British taxpayer, claim to be impartial, but have come under fire for presenting the murder of Palestinians as an equal conflict of two sides, and in the past of yielding to Israeli pressure over the nature of their coverage, and of simply not doing their job of reporting the truth of the reality of the war against the Palestinians. While Israel shows no sign of stopping the attacks on Palestinian men, women and children, millions around the world are demanding an end to the slaughter, and that mainstream media, which maintains incredible influence over public opinion, tell the facts and the truth about the devastating, deadly impact of the brutalization of the Palestinians.
As Israeli occupation forces continue to kill innocent Palestinians, media outlets like the BBC stand accused of siding with Israel, presenting a false narrative which is a far cry from reality. Richard Sudam, London.
The legacy of the past in the north of Ireland still haunts the present, particularly as the victims of the violence are still searching for the truth. For the family of those killed in the Ballymurphy massacre in 1971, their fight, first and foremost, was to set the record straight, and after 50 long years, their wait was finally over. As a coroner inquest ruled that 10 civilians, including a mother of 8 and a Catholic priest, killed across 3 days, were entirely innocent. The inquest found that at least 9 of the 10 killed were shot by the British Army, and that the force used was disproportionate, considering the paratroopers were firing from protected positions from a long distance away.
The coroner's court heard almost 100 days of evidence from more than 150 witnesses to conclude what the families of the deceased have known for 50 years, that their loved ones were entirely innocent and should not have been shot dead that day. But why have they had to wait so long for this verdict?
While the families have been vindicated, the fight to bring the perpetrators to justice is still not over, according to Patrick O'Murray, a human rights lawyer who represents them.
Prosecutions have been very rare in this jurisdiction, arising from the conflict when those who perpetrated the events are state actors. Many families would argue that we have had a de facto amnesty for British soldiers and police officers, where they haven't been subject to the normal rules of the criminal justice system or the rigours of the law.
The families feel their loved ones were killed twice, first by the British soldiers, and then their characters assassinated by the British state. Inside and outside the court, the families cheered the fact that after a long and hard-fought battle, the truth had been acknowledged, and the names of their loved ones exonerated. But their cheers were bittersweet, because not everyone lived long enough to see this day. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In the wake of the Israeli regime's attacks on Jerusalem al-Quds, pro-Palestinian demonstrators took over Downing Street in the British capital, London. The demonstrators even managed to clear out a small group of pro-Zionist demonstrators and chanted in solidarity with the Palestinian uprising against the occupation, sending a strong message of international solidarity.
Outrage is what's being voiced here on the streets of London today after Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem al-Quds, as well as the attacks and the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. On top of that as well, of course, people are voicing their frustration and condemnation of the British silence over the massacres committed in the Gaza Strip.
Now they're attacking the Gaza Strip as well. They're attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque at a time when, in the middle of Ramadan, at the most holy time for the Muslim people. This is an acceleration of the general attacks on the Palestinians, and it's completely unacceptable.
Since 1917, the British government has supported the Zionist project in Palestine, the settler colonial project that expelled the Arab Palestinians from their land, and which to this day continues to deny them their basic human rights. And today, now we see Israel is continuing this and ramping it up and is now trying to expel people from Jerusalem, from East Jerusalem, which is occupied by Israel illegally.
Demonstrators also expressed their outrage over Britain's allowing for the production of weapons to be used by the Israeli military and the UK's historic support for Israel.
According to the Arms Trade Treaty that Britain is a signatory on, they are legally obliged to assess whether the hardware that they're selling to another country is likely to be used for human rights violations. When following the 2014 war in Gaza, where you saw the massacre in Shaja'iyya, Britain, within weeks of it, Vince Cable, the business secretary, rubber-stamped the sales of millions of pounds of weaponry to Israel.
With the Gaza Strip under bombardment as the armed resistance fires rockets at Israel, the Palestinian people rise up throughout the occupied territories. This is whilst the international solidarity seems to now be stronger than ever. Robert and Lakesh, London.
Iran, Tehran, the Interior Ministry, the elections office of the country, which is now registering the hopefuls for the upcoming June presidential elections. Over 20 public figures have officially announced their intention to run for president, but the final list of candidates will be announced by the Constitution Council on May 27th. This man was the first luminary showing up, Mohammad Hassan Nami, an army general who ministered telecoms during President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He told at a brief presser that he has tens of plans for the country's future, especially in the economic fields.
I have 62 programs for my administration when I would be elected. The main six ones will be performed within the first 6 months of my term. It mainly focuses on improving the life quality of people, especially in economic terms.
The next salient figure who signed up on the first day was Saeed Mohammad, another man with military backgrounds who has served as the commander of the IRGC's construction base.
My likely government will certainly abide by the agreements reached by the incumbent administration. So as the 2015 nuclear deal is an international deal, we will comply with our commitments. This is the other side that has withdrawn from the pact unilaterally.
The third one was the former defense minister of President Hassan Rouhani, who is now serving as an advisor to the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Particularly with regard to the public livelihood, people's livelihood. Well, that has so much details, but within 2 years, I will be in contact with different associations, guilds, and the university professors. So I have had face-to-face talks with them in the past 2 years, and that has been delineated on the basis of the facts and realities in the society.
Apart from these three, Wahab Azizi, Secretary General of Jihad Garan Party, and Mohammad Zarif Fumani, Secretary General of Popular Party of Reforms, appeared to announce their bid. Some top political figures are also seen as possible presidential hopefuls, but they have not declared their decision yet. They include former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, Judiciary Chief Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, current Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Qalibaf, and Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The new interpretation of the Constitutional Council of the Election Law says that runners must be between 40 and 75 years of age with at least 4 years of managerial experience with no criminal records. This as the former military personnel must have served as Major General. With these conditions in, several of the current hopefuls may be out of the race. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation echoed from Tehran following the deadly terrorist raid on Saturday that killed dozens of schoolgirls in Kabul. Scores of people lost their lives in explosions caused by car bomb and mortar shells targeting a school in the Shia-majority neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in western Kabul. Eyewitnesses reported that the victims of the attack were mostly female students headed on their way back home. after finishing school.
I offer my condolences to the bereaved mothers of the innocent girls who lost their lives in the terrorist attack. I hold the Afghan government responsible for its inaction regarding terrorism and extremism.
We came here to express our sympathy with our fellow Afghan citizens. The fact that the terrorists committed to this heinous crime in the fasting month of Ramadan shows that they have no respect for Muslim citizens.
While Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for the Kabul attack, demonstrators here blame the incident on U.S. war of Afghanistan. They say American forces have been on the ground in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But in fact, they've been fueling the flames of terrorism. Last week, the U.S. and its NATO allies began pulling their troops and military hardware out of Afghanistan, a measure which these people say is too late.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it is always after creating chaos and insecurity by finding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it's always after creating chaos and insecurity by funding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
In a gesture of solidarity, Tehran also held this video mapping on its iconic Azadi Tower. The video projection depicted messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation.
A voice to lead, a vision for future. This is the theme for the 2021 World Nurses Day. Iran has commemorated the international occasion as this year, like the previous year, the occasion is marked with a new awareness among the public and officials as nurses, along with other health workers, take the front line in the fight against the deadly coronavirus pandemic. Speaking at a press conference on the occasion, head of Iran's nursing organization, Mohammad Mirzabeghi, said since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, over 100,000 Iranian nurses have been infected with the deadly virus, but Iranian nurses have not quit their jobs.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus epidemic, Iranian nurses have been at the forefront of the fight against the disease. More than 100,000 of them have so far caught the virus on duty, out of which 120 died of the virus. On average, 6,000 to 7,000 nurses are under quarantine due to getting infected with the virus. But as soon as they get recovered, they come back to work to take care of the patients. Such a spirit creates a beautiful picture of sacrifice in one's mind.
There are some 140,000 nurses in Iran. For hospital nurses, life under the coronavirus conditions has been much tougher and more challenging. These professional nurses have had to work extra shifts to make up for the shortage of staff.
I've been a nurse for 12 years, but the COVID-19 pandemic was the worst of what I had ever seen. I saw my colleagues losing their lives on a daily basis at the front line of the fight against the virus. Therefore, I decided to take photos of their sacrifices and hard-working efforts to take care of infected patients. My photo was selected by the International Council of Nurses as the best photo of the year in hospital category.
This global COVID-19 pandemic has shown the world the important role that nurses play in keeping people healthy across the lifespan. Therefore, nurses as the largest healthcare profession must play an integral part in planning the future of healthcare.
The World Health Organization designated 2020 as the Year of Nurses to celebrate the contributions of nurses to healthcare during the pandemic and acknowledge the challenges they continue to face as the pandemic ebbs and flows through human community worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The escalation of the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people is awakening the people of the world to the true face of the regime and prompting people from all walks of life to emerge and raise their voices.
The women and the children, we all know, is disproportionately impacted by the violence that is happening in the Al-Aqsa. And I think as women that we need to be able to stand with those women in solidarity, and that is why I'm here today.
I think the atrocities of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or a demonstration of insecurity and of awareness that the light at the end of the tunnel for Israel, for Zionist state, is an oncoming train. For us, it's the daylight. The next phase in the struggle is drawing to an end.
South Africans have always highlighted the plight of Palestinians, with numerous marches held to demand a stronger action from the government. While the ruling ANC has taken several policy decisions in this regard, it has largely failed to sign them into law. However, lobbyists are expected to put forward a bill in Parliament that will seek a boycott of Israel.
We want Parliament to discuss it as soon as possible and to adopt laws which will force everyone in South Africa, big business, universities, sports bodies, to have nothing to do with Israel.
The South African government has condemned the Israeli forces' raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and the planned evictions in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds. It slammed the move as being in breach of international law and several UN Security Council resolutions. But the country is yet to indicate any plan to downscale ties with Tel Aviv.
The demonstration year forms part of a national day of action in which sister protests have taken place in Johannesburg, Durban and other parts of the country. Protesters say they will continue their action until the government takes decisive steps. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held funerals for civilians killed in Israeli airstrikes that targeted residential areas in different parts of the enclave. The Israeli army launched the attacks on the Gaza Strip on Monday. Children are also among the victims.
My relatives were playing next to their home and the Israeli airplanes hit them and killed some of them. We are really sad, but we are ready to sacrifice anything for Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's our right and we are going to grab it from Israel by force, even if we die defending Palestine. We ask the resistance to respond.
God is greater than Israel. I lost my little son while my husband lost his legs. I'm totally speechless and I can't believe this till this moment.
The ongoing wave of violence broke out on Monday after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The Israeli airstrikes came after resistance groups in the Gaza Strip conducted rocket attacks against Israel.
Palestinian resistance will keep defending Palestinians with all means. What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is a crime, and the Israeli regime should get the punishment from Palestinians for attacking worshippers in holy places. Israeli regime is practicing terrorism policies in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Gaza Strip.
Palestinians have gathered here to mourn some of those who were killed in Israeli raids. As Israel keeps bombing and killing Palestinians, people here call on the international community to confront the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Hundreds of Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem Al-Quds. This was the latest in a series of confrontations in the Holy City. Palestinian worshippers gathered at the mosque's courtyard after performing morning prayers to prevent a planned raid by Israeli settlers later Monday as part of their activities to mark what they call Jerusalem Day. It's the day when East Jerusalem Al-Quds was occupied in 1967 and later annexed by Israel. Israeli forces raided the courtyards, firing tear gas, stun grenades and rubber bullets against Palestinians to force them out of the holy site. However, the Palestinians remained steadfast.
What is going on in Al-Quds is a massacre, a comprehensive war to evacuate the city from its real residents. Palestinians across the world don't remain silent. People in Al-Quds are clashing with the occupation forces to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They will never allow the settlers to desecrate their holy site.
After the clashes, Israeli forces decided to change the path of the Jerusalem Day flag march, so the settlers had to march through the old town's streets. The latest confrontations follow days of clashes between Palestinians and Israeli forces in the Jerusalem Al-Quds. The clashes escalated with the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, after Israel tightened its grip on the city and prevented the Palestinians to freely perform their religious duties. Palestinians demand immediate action from Arab states. They say the only appropriate response to the crimes is immediate halt of any ties with the Zionist entity.
First of all, the Palestinian leadership must cancel any agreement with the Israeli regime. Then, he should call on the Arab states to stop any effort to normalize ties with Israel. We want urgent measures by the international community to stop the bloodshed in Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The tension has also been fueled by an eviction plan in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds, where Israeli settlers have waged a lengthy battle to take over Palestinian homes. Meanwhile, Palestinians held demonstrations in Ramallah and Gaza to denounce Israel's efforts to forcefully evict Palestinians from their homes in Al-Quds. Israel's Supreme Court was to hold a hearing on the eviction on Monday, but the session was postponed due to the unrest in Al-Quds. Israeli violence has sparked international condemnation. Meanwhile, the UN chief has urged Israel to exercise maximum restraint and respect the right to freedom of peaceful assembly. Amid soaring tensions in Jerusalem Al-Quds, which has seen weeks of clashes, the Israeli authorities question whether a new uprising could now be inevitable. Unabating protests across the occupied territories have proved that Jerusalem Al-Quds is a red line for Palestinians, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Qandil occupies Ramallah.
www.parstoday.com/en. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Harzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. On Saturday, multiple explosions took place in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The death toll has risen to 68. Most of the casualties have been high school girls, as the explosions took place outside of the school when the girls were on their way home. At least 160 others were also wounded. Now, the Afghan government has blamed the Taliban. However, the Taliban has denied involvement. What is going on in Afghanistan, as we have seen a rise in attacks since Washington has announced its pullout from the country by September the 11th. Let's cross over to Kabul, joined by Amin Alami. Amin, thanks so much for being with us. Please fill us in on the latest situation.
Well, Marzia, Kabul residents witnessed another tragic day as back-to-back explosions hit a high school in western part of the capital, Kabul. According to official statistics, at least 68 civilians, most of them schoolgirls, were killed, and over 150 others sustained injuries. Most of the injured victims of this incident were shifted to nearby hospitals, as well as to Kabul's emergency hospital for war victims. I went to the blast scene, as well as I visited some of the victims of this incident in Kabul's emergency hospital. Marzia was one of those students who has sustained injuries. She said that when we were were leaving the school to home, a huge car bomb blast happened in front of the entrance gate of the school, and then I cannot remember what happened. Another man who was a shopkeeper also said that when I heard a very loud explosion, I rushed to the blast scene as I was looking for my own daughter there. He also said that after a few moments there was another blast, and it was a roadside bomb blast, and after a few minutes there was the third blast. That is why the casualties are high. According to witnesses and local residents in Qalainau area in western part of the Afghan capital Kabul, the blasts were too huge, and most of the families who live close to this high school have lost one or two of their family members. This comes as the Afghan government, specifically the Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani, strongly blamed, condemned the incident, and blamed the Taliban militant group for being behind such attack. But the Taliban also released a statement and condemned the attack and said, "We are not involved in launching attacks on civilian targets." But in the meantime, let's not forget that the Afghan capital Kabul, as well as many other big cities of this country, witnessed similar attacks in the past as well. Most of those attacks were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. For instance, I can point out at least three deadly terrorist attacks on educational centers in western part of the Afghan capital Kabul that claimed the lives of at least 150 school students and university students that were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. However, the rise of insecurity and bloodshed in Afghanistan comes as there are also efforts to bring peace and stability to this country via relying on negotiations.
All right, thanks so much, Amin, for that.
Is one of the players that stress on following the negotiations. Besides the Afghan government, the people of Afghanistan and many other rights bodies as well as independent international bodies also call on the Taliban as well as on what they name it, the supporter of Taliban, to say yes to the demand of the Afghan people.
And thanks so much. I mean, I think you have a delay. I'm not sure if you can hear me or not, but that we're going to end that with Amin Alami, correspondent in Kabul, because I definitely want to get to our main guests for this program. I'd like to welcome our guest, Madia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink out of Washington, D.C., and Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Madia, let me start with you. I mean, we look at the situation in Afghanistan and this unbelievable violence that is taking place, and we look at the involvement of the United States, 20 years in that country. What has been accomplished? Because it definitely seems that security is one of those things that has not been really brought to Afghanistan. So what has the U.S. been doing in that country all these years?
Well, it's quite horrific that after 20 years of U.S. occupation and billions and billions, if not trillions of dollars being spent, including $88 billion just training the Afghan security forces, that the U.S. and the allies have not been able to build a stable democratic government in Afghanistan. And so the violence is a testament to the fact that the United States has been part of that violence rather than being any solution that would bring peace and security to the Afghan people.
Elijah, we have seen an increase in attacks in Afghanistan recently. Why do you think that this is happening at this point in time? On the one hand, if we look at the attacks yesterday, the government pointed a finger at the Taliban denied involvement and said they do not attack civilians. And as our correspondent said, it has similar earmarks to what Daesh and others have been doing. But overall, what's your perspective about this increase?
Yes, I do really agree with your correspondent. This has had the fingerprint of ISIS rather than the Taliban. There is also a significant indication of the failure of the local security forces. I mean, the car has been there for 24 hours, and this area has been targeted before. And ISIS doesn't really target specific objective to send a message, but it's a random against civilians. This is not the way that Taliban has been doing, particularly after the negotiations that has been held in Qatar and in other places, and the will of the U.S. to withdraw, although the U.S. did not respect its deal that was concluded by Donald Trump of the withdrawal of the 1st of May. And that increases the tension in the country and increases the instability. And now Biden is saying he's going to withdraw by the 11th of September. And that puts also Taliban off its commitment, because it is not guaranteed that Taliban is not going to stop attacking the U.S., particularly when the U.S. are continuing to bomb areas under the Taliban control. Therefore, it is obvious that the security in the country is going to be hectic as long as the Americans are there and as long as there is no national reconciliation among all parties.
Lydia, why do we not see international condemnation and outrage at this increased number of attacks and fatalities taking place in Afghanistan? I mean, if we look at the situation yesterday outside of a girls' high school, if it had taken place anywhere else, we would be seeing so much people condemning what has taken place, memorials set up to remember the victims. Why isn't that the case when it comes to Afghanistan?
I think a lot of the world has turned a blind eye and washed their hands of what's going on in Afghanistan. The violence has been going on for more than 20 years. And here in the United States, there's a sense of let's just get out of there and get over this. So I think such a horrific attack that, as you say, would have made headline news all over the world is really disregarded and seen as just a part of the landscape of a place like Afghanistan. And it's just astounding that there's not more of an international outcry.
I mean, you talked about the United States. Let's talk about inside the United States, because in general, when something like this happens, exactly like you said, in a country like Afghanistan that has been under violence so long, Medea, people basically sometimes look at, well, that's just how they are over there, and not connecting the role of the U.S. government and the troops, the American troops that are there, and the lack of stability in this country. Your take, Medea.
Yes, I think the narrative is those people just fight each other. And one has to question the role of the U.S. and also where do all these weapons come from? And so much of the weapons on all sides have come from the United States that has just poured weapons into Afghanistan and all of the Middle East. And so many of the U.S. weapons companies have become enriched by this violence that's ongoing in Afghanistan and the larger region. And if the United States, after 20 years, was not able to bring any kind of stability to Afghanistan, then it has to be questioned, what was it doing? Why is the government in Afghanistan so corrupt? Was the U.S. part of this corruption? Well, of course, pouring all this money in, and the U.S. military can't even acknowledge where many, many billions of dollars goes, and then blames the Afghans for being corrupt and blames the Afghan for being violent.
Elijah, in any situation, I mean, if we look at these attacks, usually we ask the question, who benefits from these attacks? Now, you said that it was not the trademark of the Taliban, these attacks that took place yesterday, but more likely Daesh. If we look at then Daesh, and who has supported Daesh, and who has armed Daesh, does it not lead back the trail to many Western capitals?
This is a very good question. We've seen since the war in Afghanistan, 2001, we saw the growing of the Mujahideen that goes back to the U.S. finance during the Soviet era and the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And this is exactly what Hillary Clinton said. The people we are fighting today are the same people we have funded. This is really from the mouth of the foreign minister, the U.S. foreign minister, And as your guest said, I really agree. We see corruption wherever the U.S. are going. We saw that in Iraq. It's exactly the same, hundreds of billions of dollars. We see the increase of Mujahideen. We see the increase of ISIS in Syria. The Americans watch them growing in Iraq and crossing from Iraq to Syria and said nothing, and then supporting these terrorist groups also in Syria, training them and financing them. So it's exactly, history is repeating itself. ISIS is in Afghanistan as it is in the rest of different parts of Africa and the Middle East, but it's also, we see how strongly the U.S. invested in destabilizing the area, and it is time for them to leave, but leave not only Afghanistan, but leave Iraq and leave Syria.
But in your perspective, does the U.S. profit from a lack of stability? We see, for example, well, we're talking about Afghanistan right now, so I'll leave it right there with Afghanistan. Does the U.S. benefit from a lack of stability in these countries?
Well, certainly there's a sector of the economy in the U.S. that benefits all of these defense contractors, military contractors, that have made so many billions of dollars in the last 20 years, want to see these wars continue. But I certainly don't think it's something that benefits the American people, because we have been paying for these wars instead of the money going into healthcare and education and things that benefit people in this country. They've been going to support the violence and the chaos that the U.S. military is part of in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
Elijah, your prognosis in general, with the situation that has happened, of course, the U.S. was supposed to leave in May, and now it says in August, and as you said, technically, then there's no agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban. Now, do you see these talks continuing at this point, or your prognosis, especially for the next few months?
I think talks to reach a conclusion in Qatar, and when the Americans sat with the Taliban and concluded the deal, there is no more talk to be made at the exception of the U.S. leaving the country. However, we see alarming indication from the U.S. saying we will not completely leave, and we will keep a kind of counterterrorism units to keep watching what's happening in the country.
Yes.
I mean, after 100,000 troops, they didn't manage to do so. Taliban today control 30% of the districts. The other 30% that are also contested. Therefore, after 20 years with 100,000 troops, what the hell the Americans are still doing in the country? There is no justification. The deal has been made, and they should have respected it, and you should have left on May. And now Biden is begging for the Taliban not to attack, because during the attack the forces are more vulnerable, and Taliban said, we're not going to respect it because you did not respect the deal. So that's it.
Well, Elijah, what do you think that means, this anti-terror group that Washington says has to remain? What do you get from that?
I get that they will keep some kind of control on the local government. They would like to keep the dictate on the government in Kabul to make sure that their interests are still looked after in the country. Therefore, I don't think the Americans will permanently leave and definitely let the Taliban and the central government and all the other groups sit around the table and sort out their own problems. That's also not something easy to achieve. A domestic national reconciliation is not going to be so easy, but the Americans would like to keep a foothold in the country, and that is under a different title, and that they call it counterterrorism. If they consider the Taliban are no longer a threat, then there is no reason to keep the counterterrorism units in the country.
Your take on that, Madia, because we've seen, for example, we saw troops leaving Iraq, but then not really leaving Iraq. And now, as our other guest has said, about the anti-terror troops that Secretary of State said that would be left there in Afghanistan. Your assessment of all this, when the United States sees a situation, for example, Afghanistan is very important to it strategically, do you think that really that Washington is going to totally leave Afghanistan?
Well, it will certainly maintain the ability to come back in with airstrikes, with drone strikes. There will be CIA operatives. There will be people still training the untrainable Afghan military after 20 years of training. So they won't be totally gone. But I do think it is a positive thing. I agree that the troops should have left by May 1st, and it would have made the withdrawal easier. But I do think it is a positive thing that the U.S. troops will leave, and hopefully most of the contractors as well. But let's not kid ourselves. The U.S. is not going to totally wipe its hands from Afghanistan. It wants to maintain some ability to go back in.
Well, Madia, based on what you're saying, then do you see continued instability? Because if we're talking about drone strikes or being able to attack at any time, so it means, for example, if Kabul, if the government or whichever government is in power by that time and doesn't walk the walk that the United States defines, then wouldn't it be even easier for them to cause even more instability, and especially with CIA operatives on the ground?
Well, we've seen from this attack, if indeed it was ISIS, that there is that there are different kinds of groups. And let's remember, there are all kinds of warlords in Afghanistan that will be jockeying for power. It's not just the Afghan government and the Taliban. So there will be, unfortunately, a lot of violence for years to come because there are so many different groups vying for power and there are so many weapons. And this is the occupation of so many of the Afghan men that I don't think we're going to see an end to the violence in the short term.
Elijah, your prognosis for Afghanistan beyond August?
I really agree. I don't think there is going to be stability as long as there is no national reconciliation in the country. And that is really important to allow the Afghani to sort out their own problems, whatever time they need, how long they need, it doesn't matter. Even, yes, I agree there are many warlords. The country has been under a war for 20 years. That's not easy. There's a lot to be done, reconstructing also the souls and the national reconciliation. That is not going to be easy. But it will take time, but it's better to start without the Americans, without the presence of any foreign troop. Let the people of the Middle East and the West Asia sort out their own problems.
And, Madia, 1 minute I have. I mean, this war was started in 2000, allegedly the war on terror by George W. Bush. In your perspective, what has been accomplished in these 20 years by the United States in Afghanistan?
Countless numbers of Afghans killed, millions displaced, millions wounded, thousands of U.S. soldiers, over $1 trillion U.S. dollars sunk into all of this chaos and bloodshed. That's what's been, quote, accomplished in these 20 years, and it's horrific. And unfortunately, on top of all that, I don't think in the U.S. the lessons have been learned, that we shouldn't go in and invade and occupy other countries.
And with that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Madia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink out of Washington, D.C., and Elijah McNeil, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.